I think that giving the North Koreans a summit with the American president was already a massive giveaway. I mean, North Korea is just sort of like a gangster autocracy, right? I mean, it's kind of like a feudal gangster fiefdom, right? And getting to meet the American president, you know, the head of the world's oldest democracy, the superpower and all that kind of stuff, that's a big legitimizing thing if you're, you know, if you're a little tin pot dictator like Kim Jong-un. That's why no American president has ever done this before.
From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Only a few months ago, there seemed a real threat of military conflict between North Korea and the United States. Now there are summits and prospects of a deal which would see North Korea dismantle its nuclear weapons in return for security guarantees and the easing of economic sanctions. The experts are being cautious, however, about the outlook. North Korea is notoriously unreliable. But no one can deny that the climate has absolutely transformed from just a few months ago. Robert E. Kelly is a professor at the Department of Political Science and Diplomacy at Pusan National University in South Korea, and he joins us from there today. Robert Kelly, how have we got from where we were to where we are in such a short time? It seems an unexpected outbreak of reason compared with those days not so long ago when Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un were exchanging insults.
Yeah, it's a pretty revolutionary change here. I'm a little surprised myself, and I'm not entirely sold that it's all genuine and actually going to lead to anything, just because the division between the two Koreas and the United States is so old, it's so entrenched, the ideological and strategic cleavages are really large. So I would be amazed if we were able to sort of jump from, you know, nuclear war in December to peace in April. The talk has been good so far. There's a lot of nice atmospherics and stuff like that, right? But the North Koreans haven't actually floated any serious concessions yet. So it's not as if this has actually resulted in very much yet. So I'm still kind of skeptical.
There was a lot of criticism when President Trump played hardball, but was this a factor in the progress?
I think it was, but only a small one. I think the North Koreans now basically have the basic weapon capability that they want to defend themselves against an American-led regime change effort. And now that they have it, you know, they probably have a 300 kiloton weapon at least, which is pretty substantial. Now that they have that and the missiles, they can start shopping around and see what they can get for them. That's my read of this, is that they Kim Jong-un took over 7 years ago. He didn't want to talk to anybody for 7 years. We know he put his foot on the accelerator for the nuclear program. He forced it through. He finished it, did the missile tests, and now they've got it. And so, you know, now that they can strike the U.S. with a large weapon, they can start talking to the rest of the world, right? And they've sort of crossed that finish line. So why not shop around and see what you can get? If you don't get anything, then they just go back to the defensive crouch they've been in for a long time. But that's my primary read of it. I think the sanctions are sort of the broad sort of canvas against which this has happened, right? The Americans and the Chinese have been pushing China or North Korea a lot more. But I think the specific trigger was the crossing of the threshold last year that they could strike the U.S. with a weapon.
So the announcement last week of suspending all nuclear and intercontinental missile tests was less a sign of goodwill, in your view, than just a sign that they didn't need to do these anymore.
For now, they don't need to do any more. I mean, that's what it seems like. I mean, it's certainly what they're saying. I think it's, like I said, I think it's sort of a mix. The sanctions are the broad story in the background, right? We know that the sanctions have begun to bite, and we know that North Korea wants sanctions relief. They've mentioned this many times in the past, but I don't think they were actually going to address that until after they'd sort of crossed the finish line on the ability to strike the United States with a large nuclear weapon. Now that they have that, now they can start to negotiate, right? But it's pretty clear that Kim Jong-un, the current Kim, like I said, sort of put his foot on the accelerator and forced this through, right? And then he started talking, right? I mean, it would strike me as an enormous convenience or a coincidence if, you know, 6 months after they got the ability to hit the United States with this thing, suddenly it started to talk. I mean, that those two things are almost certainly linked.
This week, the leaders of the two Koreas will meet. What is this summit designed to achieve ahead of the mega summit, as it were, involving the president?
Well, I would actually argue that this one is probably a little bit more important than the Trump one, in part because it's not clear to me that President Trump is actually going to be all that prepared for this, right? I mean, we know that President Trump doesn't read a great deal. He doesn't read his briefing points and stuff like that, right? This whole thing with Donald Trump is taking place just 8 weeks after it was first suggested. I'm not sure the Americans are going to be ready to strike some kind of grand bargain. I have the feeling the Trump-Kim one is going to be a bust. I think this one is more important because ultimately this is a Korean issue, right? How they the two Koreas choose to regulate issues is really more central than what us and the Chinese and the Japanese and the rest of us think about it. I think the North Koreans are basically looking for a deal, right? They'll they want sanctions relief. I think that's pretty established now. They probably want to get some kind of economic cooperation with South Korea going again. That was lucrative for North Korea in the past. And the South Koreans are going to insist on, if not full-blown denuclearization, which the North won't give, they'll probably insist on some kind of access to North Korean nuclear sites for foreign inspectors or a missile count or something like that. I would be amazed if either of them led to like a full grand bargain that led to denuclearization. There's just not enough time to sort of work out all the details for that. It'll probably be some small beer stuff to encourage a sort of rolling process of negotiation going forward.
So is this summit process one whole process? In other words, that nothing's agreed till everything's agreed? Or can the summit between the two Koreas strike an agreement that can hold regardless of what happens later?
Well, that's one of the curious things about choosing to do these summits so quickly, right? Because normally summits take place after months or even years of negotiation, so that when the two heads of state show up, the principals walk in the room, shake hands, smile, and they hammer out maybe like one or two issues that remain or something like that. These two summits are happening sort of at the beginning rather than at the end of the chain, which means my sense is they're designed to sort of like spark or break through the logjam of negotiation with North Korea and sort of, you know, kickstart the process to get it rolling. It would be astonishing if the huge issues, again, the strategic and political divide between the two sides is so wide, it would be astonishing if that could be bridged in just 4 months. It probably can't. So my sense is, some small stuff here, but a lot of good atmospherics and sort of providing pressure on future negotiators to complete this stuff. But it is kind of odd we're doing summits first and diplomacy staff work later.
So how confident are you that the meeting with Trump, in fact, will happen?
I'd say there's probably a 50-50 chance it's not going to happen. The president's been sort of all over the place in the last couple of days on this on Twitter. I think a really big stumbling block is where it's actually going to occur. The easiest place to do it is at the DMZ, because Kim Jong-un isn't going to want to wander far from North Korea. You know, he's a dictator. He's afraid of being overthrown. I would be amazed if he would actually get on a plane and fly to Mongolia or Singapore like they're talking about. I don't think a Kim monarch has left North Korea like that in 40 years. So I'd say there's only about a 50% chance it's going to happen.
Would the president be willing to go to the demilitarized zone?
From what I'm reading, the Americans don't want to do that because that's where the South Koreans are going to do it, and Trump wants something that's more spectacular than repeating what was done a few weeks earlier.
If there is a deal, and you sound very skeptical, I must say, but what would it likely entail? What would an acceptable deal entail?
Yeah, so it's important that the North Koreans have us actually give us a genuine positive concession. A lot of what they've thrown out recently are what I would call negative or sort of pseudo concessions. That is, they're saying that they won't continue to do stuff that is provocative to us. They won't continue to do missile tests or nuclear tests. They won't do provocations on the border anymore or something like that, right? Or they will go back to economic cooperation, which benefits them, right? What we really need to see from North Korea is a costly signal. That is to say, something that actually suggests a concession that actually suggests a real cost. Will they do something that's genuinely costly to them? So, for example, will they give us a missile count or a stockpile inventory, you know, of their fissile material? Or will they, you know, close one of the gulags or something like that, right? Or stop throwing so many people in prison? I mean, they need to do something that actually shows that they're genuinely changing. Just agreeing not to attack us and provoke us is not really a concession at all. And that's really that's the problem with what we've heard from the North Koreans in the last 4 months, is mostly what they've agreed to do is to not do things that were provocative, like missile tests and provocations. They've not actually agreed to do anything that suggests real costs to them. And until they do, it's kind of nice atmospherics, but they're not making concessions yet. And so maybe they will, maybe Moon and Trump can pull it out of them, but they're not even floating anything out there yet. So that's hence my skepticism.
If they did make concessions, how would their compliance?
Yeah, that's the big trick, right? So if we actually get some movement on these things, right? You know, if we get some movement on nukes and missiles, which is what everybody wants, then you have to get verification, which would almost certainly mean foreign inspectors. Now, the North Koreans probably won't agree to South Korean or American or Japanese inspectors. Those would be ideal. They probably won't agree to them. So it's probably going to mean the IAEA or some neutral third party, you know, I don't know, like Pakistan or South Africa or something like that. The U.S. and South Korea would be pretty uncomfortable with that, would be my guess. Probably the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, but the North Koreans have had pretty rocky relations with them in the past too. I mean, I think this is one of the big stumbling points. This is why I think that a grand bargain is just not in the works after such a short period of time. The North Koreans have traditionally fought, you know, deep down in the weeds, sort of like trench warfare over these kinds of things in past negotiations. They don't give up stuff very easily. So it would be amazing if suddenly they did this time. So my guess is the deals will probably be a lot smaller so that the verification issues, which means foreigners running around North Korea, are less intrusive.
Would that still be worth having?
Well, at the summit level, no. No, I think particularly that the Trump-Kim summit is a mistake and should be canceled. But both summits, I think, are way too premature. I would like to see a lot more diplomacy and staff work going in to these. I would like to see some kind of genuine North Korean concession that actually proves they're willing to carry a real cost for us. You know, agreeing to do like inter-Korean rail or reopen the Kaesong Industrial Zone, something like that, from which the North Koreans benefited. Those aren't concessions. And I really wish that the Moon government would stop suggesting that those are actually concessions, because they're not. Because the North Koreans are pocketing gains from those. What we really need to see is the North Koreans actually give up something. Again, it would be sort of astonishing if they chose to do that sort of on live television on Friday, because now they're talking about televising this thing, right? That's the kind of thing that gets hammered out and sort of back and forth when staff meet. And that's because we know that from the past from negotiating with North Korea. So I don't know if the summits are going to work. It's very uncharacteristic to do summits before staff work.
There's also the problem, isn't there, of staging a deal in the sense that the Americans would want to see tangible evidence of the dismantling of the nuclear arsenal before loosening the sanctions, because otherwise it would be the problem of putting them back on again if things went badly.
Yeah, that's right. Sequencing has always been one of the real problems too. And again, this is why I would argue for the staff work and the diplomacy first, or to get into the weeds, get into the trenches, and really hammer out these very precise details. Because this is how deals with the North Koreans have collapsed in the past. Both sides agreed to do something. One side was supposed to do it and didn't do it. The other side was waiting, blah, blah, blah. And then things start to spin apart. It's not clear to me that that problem has been resolved.
There's also been fear expressed that Trump might give away too much when he gets onto the celebrity stage, as it were.
Yeah, I am concerned about that. I think that giving the North Koreans a summit with the American president was already a massive giveaway. I mean, North Korea is just sort of like a gangster autocracy, right? I mean, it's kind of like a feudal gangster fiefdom, right? And getting to meet the American president, you know, the head of the world's oldest democracy, the superpower and all that kind of stuff, that's a big legitimizing thing if you're, you know, if you're a little tin pot dictator like Kim Jong-un. That's why no American president has ever done this before, right? Because we don't want to sort of record them the legitimacy of actually meeting someone as esteemed as the American president. And Donald Trump didn't realize that. He just gave this thing away 45 minutes after it was first prompted to him. So I'm actually very concerned. This is one reason why I think the Trump-Kim summit is such a bad idea. We know Donald Trump is going to wing it. He's going to walk in there. He's not going to be prepared. He just doesn't do the reading. We know this. So he's going to walk in there. He's going to wing it. And I'm very afraid he might just give something away because he doesn't realize it. So he's just unlike any American president we've ever had. And I think it's very, very risky to have him in there.
We talk about things in terms of the Americans and the North Koreans, but of course there are other players that are important too. What about the attitudes of Japan and China to all these diplomatic developments?
Yeah, I think the Japanese to a certain extent have been cut out of this. I think mostly they're just concerned that, you know, there be some kind of caps on North Korea's program so that they're not under the gun. They also have a side interest in, if we're going to have some kind of final deal with North Korea, they have a side interest in working out some of the abductee issues between them and North Korea. The North Koreans basically abducted a bunch of Japanese speakers in the 70s to teach their spies how to speak Japanese. But I'm not sure that the Japanese have any sort of deep particular interest in the details of, you know, how the two Koreas might federate or something like that. For the Chinese, it's a little bit more serious, right? Because the Chinese have a longstanding interest in North Korea as a buffer state between them and the robust democracies of Japan, South Korea, and the United States. And I think this is why the Chinese basically summoned Kim Jong-un to come to Beijing a couple of weeks ago, right? Because the Chinese want to make sure they know what's going on, right? That any final deal has to make sure that China's interests are accounted for.
Let's say there is some deal. How would you rate the chances of that deal holding, for example, for 5 years?
Oh, that is a really good question. Maybe 1 in 3. I think the big issue for North Korea, traditionally, you know, verification and implementation sequencing, these have traditionally been problems we've negotiated with North Korea. That's true. I think this time the chances of compliance are a little bit higher because the whole world is watching. I think there's sort of greater pressure on North Korea than, for example, the last time the U.S. and South Korea or North Korea had a deal in 2012 called the Leap Day deal. That kind of fell apart quickly, but that was sort of negotiated at the diplomatic level and the rest of the world wasn't paying attention, stuff like that. I think if the North Koreans do it now, after two big summits, particularly with an American president, then everybody's going to think they're cheaters, right? And so my sense is the North Koreans are taking this more seriously than they have in the past.
And looking much further into the future, do you see the chance of the Koreas reunifying ever?
Yeah, I do. I think ultimately that North Korea is not a sustainable system. And at some point, North Korea is going to collapse through either a revolt, an Arab Spring-style revolt, or more likely some kind of internal coup. I think ultimately that the two sides, I think there's a general sort of desire on both sides in the public for unity. I think the North Korean system is ultimately sort of a stagnant, backward-looking one. It would amaze me if it continues indefinitely. I would say, though, that I think a lot of people are surprised it still exists, right? So I don't want to put a timeline on that, but I would be amazed if North Korea were to hang on in perpetuity. It's just not designed to deal with modernity, right? It really is a backward-looking state sort of trapped in the late 1940s.
So do you think that eventually it could just implode internally, that people would put so much pressure on that the regime simply couldn't continue?
Yeah. My guess is there will probably be some kind of factional split at the top at some point that the Kims will sort of overstep or make an error or something like that. And there will be pressure internally. And then North Korea would probably evolve from the sort of totalitarian Kimist tyranny that it is now into a fairly typical authoritarian military dictatorship, something like Myanmar 10 years ago. And then at some point you'd have a unification after that. I mean, the most important block in unification is the Kim family tyranny, right? When you remove that, then North Korea isn't really unique anymore, right? If you don't have this sort of like weird Kimist idolatry, this sort of pagan cult around the Kim family, then North Korea is just a military dictatorship like any other one. And then it can start negotiating with South Korea for some kind of deal for current elites not to get, persecuted in the new order, right? The real trick is to get the Kims out of the way.
It sounds a bit of a hard task.
Yeah.
Now, just finally, coming back to the current diplomatic play, if it all falls apart, what then? Will the situation in fact become more dangerous between the United States and North Korea than if this had never happened?
So let me put it like this. I think there's a 70% chance that the talks are just a bust, that nothing comes out of them because there wasn't enough time to prepare a lot of diplomatic ground, and you just get like a bunch of nice photographs and nothing really comes of it. There's a 20% chance that it really goes badly, that the two of them engage in what they did last year on Twitter, the sort of like insult tennis of, dotard and fat man and all that kind of stuff, right? And then things are really sort of hairy and Trump walks out of there furious. And then there's maybe a 10% chance that the president can't actually do his art of the deal thing and actually, wrangle a deal out of the North Koreans. My real concern is that 20% figure I gave you for this thing going badly, that's substantially higher than in normal summits, right? Because you've had years of staff work beforehand. So the deal is sort of preset before you walk in, so there are no big surprises. In this case, I'm very concerned that the North Koreans sort of do something that drives Trump up the wall. If they comment about his hair or something ridiculous like that, Trump walks out of there. He's already said he might walk out of the talks if it's not fruitful. And then John Bolton says to him, the hawk John Bolton says to him, I told you the North Koreans were going to negotiate. This is why we have to hit them. I mean, there is this kind of conspiracy theory or whatever out there that one of the reasons that Bolton is not objecting to these things is because he thinks it's going to fail. And then when it does, it gives him the casus belli that he's been looking for, right? That now he can hit North Korea because it's been proven that diplomacy doesn't work.
Very high stakes all round. Robert Kelly, thank you for talking with us. And Robert Kelly will be appearing in Canberra as part of the Lowy Lecture Series on Wednesday, May 2, and at the Sydney Writers Festival, which will be held from Friday, May 4th to Sunday, May 6th. And that's all from our podcast for today. Thank you to Eliza Erlage, my producer, and goodbye until next time.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.